Welcome to 91.3 WUKY's podcast. I'm Joshua Baer. We've got a special Curtains at 8 from the archives, originally aired October 9, 2008, with Nick interviewing a Kentucky icon in educational television, O. Leonard Press, founder of KET. With them is Florence Huffman from Clark Publishing, discussing Press's book, The KET Story. Enjoy.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Curtains at 8. I'm Nick Lawrence. Pleased to be here with you. Pleased also to be here tonight with a gentleman who is venerable and who has been one of the most important media persons to the state of Kentucky since media became available, and that includes newspapers. Leonard O. Press is my guest tonight, Leonard. I am just absolutely thrilled to have you here.
Thank you, Nick.
It has been a while since...
I know what venerable means, too, by the way.
You have a way with words. You should have been a journalist or something. Something like that. 1952?
I came in 52.
Yeah? And how have things changed since 52, in a nutshell?
Well, I couldn't find my way in. That was one thing that's changed.
That's amazing.
I don't know where I am now that I'm here. Yes. That's another thing that's changed.
Well, that helps with Curtains at 8, not knowing exactly where you are.
And when I moved here in 52 and in 55, we bought a house out on Southland Drive.
Yeah.
It was the wilderness. It was a farmland.
Mm-hmm. Rosemont Dairy was probably still out there between Southland Drive.
It was. Mm-hmm.
Southland Shopping Center opened in 1952. They gave away a light blue Chevrolet sedan, a coupe, rather, and it went to someone in the Devine family who owned the grocery where Wilkins Guitar Shop is now. Does that make you feel a little bit more like you know where you are?
Makes me feel like I don't own nothing. I mean, you remember everything. What a memory.
Oh, man. Those were good times.
Now, actually, at that time, we were living at the Wellington, so we didn't know about this end of town.
The Wellington on Main Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful building there.
It is.
Tudor style and all
still
that.
Still is, yeah.
Okay, 52, 62, 72, 82, 92, 02.
I wish you'd stop that.
My God, you've been here for almost six decades, Lynn.
I have.
Yeah?
I intend to be here for six decades.
Well?
Or more.
That sounds like a good idea to me. The history of KET is the history of Leonard O. Press. You were the station manager
you
here.
You do know that you're misnaming me. You do know that, don't
no,
you?
No, tell me that. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, Leonard Press.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Just remember that if you add an apostrophe,
Irish.
I'm Irish. What?
I thought you were Irish.
Well, I just going to say, yeah.
Let's see.
That's right.
Oh, Leonard Press. Okay.
I'm sorry.
I stand corrected, and the keyboard and the telephone board lit up also. Somebody else was going to key me up.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I like about my job. I can't make a mistake for very long. Anyway, the history of KET is the history of O. Leonard Press.
Thank you.
You served as general manager of WBKY, now WUKY.
Well, actually, yes and no.
Okay. Correct me if necessary.
When I came, there wasn't a staff of WBKY.
Was it just Bromo Seltzer?
Seltzer had left the year I came. That's why I came.
Yeah.
But Cam Halyard was head of the department, and I was hired in to be director of programming.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't any staff until a year later when I created a staff out of the staff. It's out of the students themselves. I thought it would be a good experience for them.
Great.
So we named a manager and a copywriter and a traffic manager and everything you've got in a regular radio station. If that's what we were training these kids for, mm-hmm. was to go into commercial broadcasting. And so there was a manager then, but I was never it.
Now, when you got here, you had some radio background already. Where did you hail from and what was the experience?
I came from Boston, where I had been... graduated from Boston, got my graduate degree from Boston, and then was asked to come to the publicity department at Boston University and mm-hmm. do radio publicity. Television had not, well, it was just about arriving at that time.
52 is when we got our first set.
Where?
Here.
In Lexington?
In Lexington.
52. the Lexington station hadn't come on yet.
No, it hadn't yet.
You had to have a high antenna and pick it up from Louisville.
We had a tenor rotor. Remember those tenor rotors?
I sure do.
And point at Louisville or point at
Cincinnati.
You
had a little dial on the top of your set, and you set it by direction.
Yeah, and then as soon as somebody said it, somebody else who was viewing said, oh, no, turn it some more. No, that's too much.
Yeah.
All that.
That was when I was here, yeah.
So Boston U.
And I worked there for 4 years, and television arrived just about the time I did, and I started doing publicity on television. And one of the ways I did that was by featuring the faculty doing their thing, teaching. And at that time, the television station had no use for its morning hours because there weren't enough homes out there with television to sell time. So they let me have it, and I did telecourses, although I didn't know it at the time because there was no name for it. And then I got a call from Kentucky, and that was the whole story.
Yeah, how did you happen to get a call from Kentucky? How did they know about you? How did you know about them?
I had decided to leave Boston University after 4 years because I wanted to try something else, and I was going to New York. But before I left, I sent out a sort of a broadside to, I don't know, about 30 or 40 universities because I was in College Public Relations. That's who I contacted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I headed for New York, and I got a job there at Cal Bayer. You ever hear of it? And you may have heard about it. It was the biggest PR firm in the world at that time. Anyway, I got a job there. But it didn't start for 2 months. And then I got a call from Kentucky, from Cam Hadyard. And she had seen one of the flyers and had checked up on me and
made you an offer you couldn't refuse?
Made me an offer that I did refuse.
Oh, okay.
I refused it twice. And she was very persuasive and very persistent. And she kept calling back. And then finally, in the last conversation, she said, you know, we're going to get a television station here.
Uh-huh.
That excited me. And I said, well, we've already got this job lined up. I mean, my wife wants to go to New York. I want to go to New York. But thanks anyway. And she said, I tell you what. She says, you're young. I was 30. She was 25. She says, you're young. Why don't you come for a year? And I said, hey, that sounded, you know, I'd never been out of Boston, really.
Yeah.
That might be an adventure for a year. I can always come back. But I couldn't.
Once you got here.
Once I could, yeah.
What was it about Kentucky that
The people. Love the people. Love the people I was working with. Love the people I met. They were, you know, we were working at the university, so a lot of university people. And Lil was working for VLK, which is where Cam's husband was the program manager. So he hired her. And there didn't seem to be anybody but young people in this town except at the Wellington Arms. As a matter of fact, that's how we got the apartment, Nick. We applied, and the manager said, oh, hell, we got a line a mile long of established Lexingtonians who just love to get in here. So I'm afraid there isn't any chance. And then as we were walking out the door, he says, wait a minute. He says, gee, I'd love to have some young people here. And so we walked back and signed up.
Yeah.
And that's how we wound up with all the, we were the newlyweds, they were the nearly-deads, as they say.
Well, Wellington Arms goes back a few years. I'm not sure how old the building is, but it's
older than I am. I know.
Older than I also. Old Leonard Press here with us tonight on Curtains of Eight. We're pleased to have him here. We've even gotten his name correct, finally.
Yeah.
And you were very gentle in nudging me into proper form there. That's good.
Well, you were very receptive. Otherwise, I would have insisted, and then we would have had fun.
could have been fun.
Yeah.
You know what we better do? We probably better introduce your editor and tell people what we're here for.
I wish you would.
You think I should?
Oh, yes. Yeah, she's something else.
Well, with
won't
us
say
tonight, Florence Huffman is here from the Clark Publishing Group. And we're here tonight, Florence, to talk about Old Leonard Press's book.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Well, I know that it's a good time when somebody from Clark Publishing is here. We've had you all on several times.
Yes.
And we'll be having you several more times in the near term. Okay, tell me about the book.
Well, he knew I was going to say well. It's been a wonderful experience. The one thing that I've learned as an editor, probably the most fascinating part of the job
is dealing with the authors.
Is working with authors and getting to know the depth of an author. And with Lynn, the joy and the difficulty was that he was so humble, and I use that word, he's grinning at me now, but he wanted to make sure that everyone who reads this book understands that it really did take a Commonwealth of villages, and that he had not only students who came and stayed, such as Jenny Fox and Sid Webb and numerous people that he continues to name, but that it was what was one of the most challenging jobs for me. It was to lure out of him the personal stories that he was reluctant to tell because he didn't want anyone to perceive his book as about him. This is a book about Kentucky Educational Television and the village of people, small people, government people, governors, senators, people who invited him to their homes, and there were three people to talk with him about that. But what KET stands for today is revealed in this book, and I think one of the most telling things about KET today is that what we've learned is that the editorial integrity and the mission of Kentucky Educational Television began in its genesis with this gentleman and what he believed that it should be and what it should mean to him. And one of my favorite stories that I feel honored to have invited him to tell us is about when he first went to the mountains of Kentucky. And perhaps he'll tell us that story
Where did you go?
Cordia. Do you know Cordia?
Cordia. Yes, Cordy. The local folks call it Cordy?
No.
No?
I don't think so. if they do, none of the local folks I met called it that.
Cordia. Where is Cordia?
It's on Lots Creek.
Lots Creek would right. be what, Perry County?
No, it was just outside of Hazard.
Okay.
Which, if I remember, is Perry County. Is it?
That is Perry County. It was Knox County, I think.
And that's something, by the way, I've learned to do in Kentucky, but in Massachusetts, counties didn't mean much. And you didn't know what county you lived in because everybody identified your places of living by city name. But here, of course, it's just the other way around.
It is like that. And being a Kentuckian, you can sometimes tell about where someone is from by their speech, from what part of the state. For example, Estill County has mastery of a triphthong. If you ask someone what time it is, they will say Sayeoven with three syllables on the front end.
Yes,
Sayeoven.
I have learned how to stretch syllables, particularly on some unspeakable words.
I mean the ones that, never mind.
Never mind.
Never,
right.
mind,
yeah,
never, never, mind, never mind. mind.
Never mind.
Okay, so you went to Cordia and Lots Creek.
And there was a, we met a lady by the name of Alice Sloan, who was the founding director of the Lots Creek Community School. This is a school that had no state funds, didn't even have state accreditation, and yet they were teaching kids, home kids. Some of them they had a board because the terrain was so rough they couldn't navigate it, particularly in the wintertime. But they were determined to see that the kids had a better deal than some of their parents did.
Mm-hmm.
And so they taught them, and a high percentage got into college. They did very well, and most of them required help from home to go to college. And Alice and her school provided some of that on one condition, and that was that if they were ever needed back home as a teacher or whatever, they would come. And they had many doctors who came back and lawyers who came back.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful story. But they were obviously having difficulty, I mean, with curriculum and with teachers and with providing the kind of resources you could get in the city.
Right.
Well, excuse me, I'm just over a cold. I had been around that sort of, I mean, the media part of it. And putting the two together was no great leap of the imagination. I mean, here you've got television. I knew what it could do in education because I'd done that at Boston University.
Mm-hmm.
Here were people who needed that kind of a resource, and they knew what they'd do with it if they could get it. And so I set out to try to get it.
So this was sort of an epiphany
it was.
For you?
Yes, it was. It was an epiphany. I would have done that anyway. I mean, that's where I was heading. And we did make some attempts to get a station just at the University of Kentucky. But the epiphany was realizing it had to be a statewide system. It had to get to the rural areas. The cities didn't need it that bad as did.
And so then you took it up as a matter of television. Now, the TV that you were promised to come down here for would have been UK TV?
I guess. I mean,
this is pre-KET.
Oh, yes.
Oh, oh, yes. Oh, yes.
The University of Kentucky, WBKY TV, probably.
This was, no, it was 16 years before KET. No, BKY.
BKY.
WBKY is here.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been here for probably 10, 12 years when I came.
Right.
And it was just used, that was kind of an interesting story. Sulzer, the man who started WBKY, who was in the music department here, he was a musician. And he had a student orchestra. And then he got the idea, from where, I don't know, like probably the same place I got my ideas, to set up a radio station for the university. I guess the music part of it is. With, of course, educational radio at that time was mainly classical music.
You know? Right, and I think he had a bridge of some sort with WHAS in Louisville.
He did. Mm-hmm. He did. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he started the radio station, and then he needed, he wanted his orchestra here. Your Studio A, the old, well, I don't know what you got here now, but the old Studio A was built as a music studio. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. Because
the polycylindrical walls, if I'm saying that right?
Yes.
Designed for music, not for radio.
Yes. 30-foot high ceilings, full width of the building, and as far down as the water fountain.
Right.
A production floor that used to see big orchestras, big name orchestras come through, and you could probably tell me about that. I've heard about it. Benny Goodman, Lester Lannon, everybody played at Joyland Friday and Saturday night, and then he came here and did concerts live on Sunday on the floor.
Yeah.
That was...
Actually, that may have been just... Joyland was not before my time, but Benny Goodman being here was. I would have known it. I saw Lionel Hampton at Joyland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But... excuse me. Anyway, Bromo got his orchestra, student orchestra, and then he gave them scholarships to play. By the time I got here, the orchestra was gone. Sulzer was gone. Scholarships were still here.
Yeah.
That's what I used for the student staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody ever asked.
Yeah,
I don't say that.
So it was kind of a laboratory station for the communication students, which at that time were called RTF students?
When I came, it was just radio arts.
Just radio arts.
It became films when we bought a Bolex camera, basically a home high-end camera.
8mm?
8mm Bolex.
24 frames per second?
Yeah. And that was our film, and we never got the television until we got KET.
Never got it?
No.
Well, I took a television production course here and radio production course here. It would have been in 1965. And there was a Vidicon camera set up in this studio where we are now, old B studio. And... We had a deal with Channel 27 to get out there on Thursday afternoons, and we had, a two-hour lab. We got to use their two I.O. cameras and one Vidicon.
Well, that Vidicon wasn't here when I left, but you arrived just after I left. I want to show you what was here, what we used for television.
You got pictures in the book?
I have a picture in the book, yeah.
Dang.
It's...
While you're looking, I want to point out a subtlety in what Florence was telling us about editing your work. Leonard Presk is always handy with a story. He's a good storyteller. But you were looking for stories that revealed some parts and pieces of himself.
Yes. He had the story that he presented was a very accurate story. He had the drive for the story to be very accurate in terms of who was involved and when it happened. And so the book reveals itself, and it begins with his coming to Kentucky and then going through the 25 years that he was the head of KET. And then he has some really interesting insights near the end. But I tell you, one of the things that I think Kentucky readers, especially, and anyone who knows Lynn and Lillian Press, is his introduction to Kentucky politics, and how I particularly found the story of and he berates me every once in a while, as only Lynn Press can berate one, about the
very gently and thoroughly.
Yes, completely.
Thoroughly.
Yes, but the stories of how it never he would almost quite get there, and then some bureaucratic some step there would be, maybe it wasn't the deed wasn't done, but you couldn't get the money from the FCC, and it was almost like it would have been maddening to most people, and his 1 year adventure kept re-upping for that 1 year, and so until, you know, he got what he wanted, but it was because he never let go of the dream, and he's sitting there now. I love the story. He told me once that, and it's in the book, that it always made him uncomfortable when people ask him, "Aren't you proud?"
Mm-hmm.
Right, mm-hmm. Mr. Press?
Mm-hmm. You want me to finish that?
I do.
Well, I'm proud of all the people who made it possible, who really did it, and who made it work, and who made the vision a reality. I just was putting one foot in front of the other, something I learned to do in the Army. And it's amazing how much ground you can cover if you just keep putting one foot in front of the other. It just came naturally. I don't know that proud suggests that I was heading for something, that I knew what I wanted and that I was going to get it, and then I was going to sit back and say, "Hey, look at that! Look
I'm
at
proud.
Me!" Well, isn't that way?
Sounds like you sort of put it together as it was occurring and staying with it. And we're going to get into some of the history and background on KET, the actual formation.
I'll just say it is like Florence said, it was like the Perils of Pauline, you know, the Saturday morning movie serial. And
tied her to the railroad track.
Yeah, well, it really was like that, amazingly so. Every time you got...
With the piano.
A little vibrato there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like that.
The formative years of KET, and I think I would like for you, if you would, give us some of the underpinnings in the actual convergence of the factors that came to become KET. UKTV department was a name, but not much of a facility. And KET came in and fulfilled a role and still is fulfilling a role in the community all across the state, and contributing greatly to PBS national programs. But the underpinnings, the beginnings of that, who did you talk to first if you had the idea to do it? What did you do with the idea? You probably talked to Lil first, I'm going to guess that.
Yeah, that's true. And Lil has always said, sure, go for it. And as quite an accomplisher herself, she spoke with authority. But anyway, the first thing I did was to draw up a plan, a kind of a blueprint of what it would take to cover the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with something like eight television transmitters. It turned out to be, it's now 16 plus digital, which is more than I can count. And then I wrote a couple of handbooks about why Kentucky should have. I like to write, so I wrote these up. Then the question came, who do I show this to?
Mm-hmm.
What do I do about it? Not knowing any better, and there's a great advantage to being ignorant sometimes. I thought, well, I guess the top gun is the governor. So how do I get to talk to the governor? And almost literally, that's what happened. And Elizabeth Taylor, whom you know, was working with me then, and she had contacts. And when Burt Combs was elected, it turned out to be somebody she had known before and worked with.
This would have been 56, 57?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, Liz, can you get me in to see him? She says, I think I can. And she did. And that's where it all started.
I think there's a little story that goes with that also.
The what?
A little story that goes with that about getting in to see the governor.
Yeah. Well, he tells that story, yeah. He says, I told my secretary to hold him off as long as possible. As he said, I had enough problems on my hands then. He says the teachers were mad at me because I wasn't paying enough in salaries, and the superintendents were mad at me because I wasn't building enough school buildings. And he said, I just didn't need any more trouble with the teachers. So I told her to hold him off, but eventually he got in, and I said, okay, to his secretary. He said, give him 10 minutes, no more. And he says, the 10 minutes stretched to 30 minutes. The 30 minutes stretched to 60 minutes. And then I found myself promising to introduce legislation for an educational television network.
And had you any experience? Were you an old hand at introducing legislation?
You know the answer.
I know the answer to it.
But let me add one other thing to that recitation that wasn't on the TV. And he said the first thing I did once it happened 2 years later was when he introduced it. He said the first thing I did was name a very large advisory committee. He said I didn't know about this fella, as he put it in his Manchester twang. He says, I didn't know about this fella. And he says, if this thing were going to go south, I wanted company.
Yeah. Tell him his nickname or what he called you. That's one of my favorite things that we kind of...
Well, he also said that I was the amiable irritant that it took to make something like that happen. And I'm pretty sure he was smiling, so I took that as a compliment.
That's a coined phrase now.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Well, at the time, I wasn't sure about that.
So the committee that was appointed ended up becoming the board of directors?
No, it didn't. No, no. He
totally
named
different.
He named a board. He named a 9-member board, which is what the law called for.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy Owsley and me and Dick Van, who's, well, 9 people. And I was one of them. And Roy Owsley was named chairman. He was a businessman from Louisville. And I was named vice chairman and so on and so on. Usual thing. Then, but in 1962, when the legislation was actually introduced, then Burt Combs said to me, now, he says, we have to get it through the legislature and I'll expect your help. And I thought, hey, you're the boss. Just tell them you want it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how smart I was about politics. Anyway, and at that time, legislators were a lot more amenable to what the governor wanted than they are now. But even so, they had the final vote. So that was my next job, was how the heck do I get to – where do you start with a legislator? I mean, there are 138 of them. Which one do I go to? And as it happened, some friends of mine in Lexington, Dave Wilson and his wife Connie. Connie we had known since Boston days, and Dave was an entrepreneur here from Louisville. And one of his boyhood friends was Tom Leo Ray, who at the time was majority leader of the House. And Dave said, hey, why don't we go see him? Connie said, why don't we go see him? So we did. We paid him a visit in his apartment. They set it up. Come to find out, he was very close with Milo Cook, who was the minority leader, and Harry King Lohman, who was the Speaker of the House. And they were all there that night when we came to visit.
Hmm.
And I pulled out my literature, and I showed it to them, and I talked and I talked, and they were very receptive. And before the legislature was over, this was in late March, so it was very close to the end of that session. They introduced a referendum, a resolution, calling for an LRC study on the merits of this plan. And that's how I got into the legislature, and one thing led to another.
Tell me how you felt the night that you went over there and all those dignitaries were there. How did Lynn feel? What's going on inside?
Well, my first reaction truly is I have a great awe of dignitaries, as you call them, of major figures, of important people. But I can honestly say that I was so full of this thing that didn't stifle me at all. I was impressed. I was impressed when I walked into the governor's office. I was even more impressed when I walked out with his promise.
30 minutes later, yeah. Right?
Hour later.
Oh, an hour
it
later.
It was an hour later.
Oh, mm-hmm. I see. So then you go to LRC. Let's just trace the rest of the history through the
legislature
formation.
This is a good story.
Yeah.
The legislature passed the resolution quickly. But that was easy because there was no appropriation attached to it.
It was a resolution to go into committee, in other words.
It was a resolution to ask or for the legislature to request, which was a demand actually, of the LRC, which is the commission that serves the legislature, mm-hmm. to do a study on this and to see if it's a good idea. And the assistant director of the LRC was a very good research scholar by the name of Ed Stinn. He's a doctor. And he did the study, and he took 2 years to do it. And when he was finished, he really had a very good piece of work.
Nailed it down.
And that's when we went to the legislature asking for money, but that's a whole other story because we didn't get it.
When you eventually got KET set and began to physically form up, did you hark back to the doctor's plan?
Absolutely.
For clarity? Absolutely.
As I say in the book, you can see the outlines of his plan and everything that's – is KET. Now, I did add something to his one, what I think is the most important element to his plan, which he did not have in there. At that time, it was common for ETV stations to charge the schools for their service.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them belonged to the school. Well, no, not many of them belonged to schools. That wasn't true in Louisville, but it was in many places. And I said, if the schools have to pay for this, then the kids I'm trying to reach most, the kids in the rural areas, are not going to have it because they're not going to be able to afford it. That's not going to work.
Right.
So he put in there that the state would pay for it. And then I said, and while you're at it, put in there the state will also buy the equipment for them because they have the same problem with the equipment.
Yeah. Oh, by the way.
And he said, well, he and my legislative mentor said, that isn't going to fly. That'll be too much money, and they'll throw the whole thing out. Get what you can now, and then we'll talk about that later. So that's what I did.
Okay.
And the plan developed into something we could begin to work with. We made applications for licenses. Ron Stewart, who was my chief engineer and partner in this, and Liz Taylor. Ron drew up all the engineering plans. We executed those lawyerly-like applications on our own because we couldn't afford lawyers. I was being supported by the university and my university salary, but practically no expenses other than that. And Ron was working for me here, so he got his salary. And a highlight of the story is that when we finally finished them, we wanted to take them to the airport, and we had to take them to Washington to actually take them into the FCC. They didn't fit in his car. He had a Austin Healey convertible, fortunately. And my car, my wife had my car, our car. So we put the top down. And
on the Austin Healey?
On the Austin Healey. And they came up beyond the level of the car. So I had to hold him, sit on him and hold him down. And we raced off to the airport and delivered him in grocery carts to the FCC.
My. Oh, Leonard Press here with us tonight on Curtains at 8. We're pleased to have him here. He is the father of much of the public broadcasting in this area. at least an uncle on radio and definitely a paternal role for KET. KET has distinguished itself in so many different ways. You had, I think, three leaders altogether, yourself, counting as one, Jenny Fox, and Mac
Wall.
And each of you served for quite a period of time, not a high turnover position. I'm going to ask you a really tough question, if you don't mind. If you would characterize the flow of events in each one of the three regimes. You started off in black and white, Jenny came in color, and Mac is digital.
Actually, I was coming in black and white, but before we finished, color came, and in fact, we actually changed our rotors on some of our cameras in transit. And so we started out in black and white, but we were already colorizing at that time. Just that was the time. It was 68 when color came in. And for the first 29 years, which were my 29 years as manager, there were two of us. There was me and there was Ginny. Ginny was there. I hired her just before we went on the air. She built the education program, the school programs.
Which was exactly what you had in mind.
Exactly. I was no expert in that at all. So for her, it was just a continuation of what she was doing. Plus, she already knew everything I knew because she had worked beside me for so long. She was my assistant. She was my deputy. She was, you know, she was just a partner, total partner to me all that time. So what happened when I left is that digital was coming in. I got the satellites in the schools just before I left. But then Jenny came in and created a total digital environment for KET. And they went from 16 stations to 32 to what's 64? I don't know.
Something like that. Mac was here talking about what they've gone to with the digital antennas and how many signals he's got to carry.
See, you're mixing your metaphors. Digital antennas.
Well, yeah.
Is there such a thing?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I think
okay.
so.
Okay. I really feel so out of it now. I mean, when I left, we were still programming for 16 channels. Well, it was actually 16 slave transmitters. I mean, there was only one channel.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've got all these mini channels. So Jenny carried on beautifully, but then she was already doing beautifully. It was either one of us kind of could have done it. No, I couldn't have done it without her. She could have done it without me. She did do it without me. And then Mac came in and inherited all of that, and I can't even begin to tell you what he's done since because it's beyond my comprehension.
Beautiful.
I've seen some examples of it, and it's wonderful stuff. Educationally, it's wonderful stuff.
The placing of television in the schools was probably a front that had to be won battle by battle, school by school, I'm going to guess. No?
No.
Easy?
I worried about that. Lyman Ginger worried about that a lot. Bob Martin, who had been superintendent of public instruction, worried about that a lot. People in the governor's office, which is one of the things that slowed me down for 2 years. Or more, was that people in the governor's office worried about that, and the education lobby at that time was even stronger than it is now. I think it was more pointedly strong at that time. It was, and they were worried about it. They were afraid of it. They were afraid of just what you're talking about, Nick. But it wasn't true. A third of the schools in this state, when I started on this project, a third of the schools already were getting educational television from out of state and paying Tennessee and Indiana and Missouri and
were they whatever. Networked with Boston?
I know we got seven stage rounds, huh?
Were they networked with Boston and all that?
Oh, no, there's nothing like that. No, PBS wasn't there yet. There was no networking when I started. And so a third of the schools were already into it. And when I went and Governor Breathitt worried a lot about the KEA, as he well should have. You know what I'm talking about, the Kentucky Education Association.
Right.
when I got into it, I went to the KEA too, and I lobbied with them. And I didn't find that fear. As a matter of fact, I got some organized help, like from Martha Del Sanders, who was at the time president of the Teachers Association of the KEA, Classroom Teachers Association. And she got me a resolution. So in the long run, in the end, we were able to convince the governor that the schools really were not afraid of it, and they never were. They never were. The teachers understood that this was a useful tool, and they were glad to have it. That was my experience. Now, maybe earlier, if we'd been earlier, there would have been, but there wasn't when I was there.
And what year did you actually get to broadcast into the classrooms?
1968. September 23rd, 1968.
So it took you, what's the overarching time period that it took you from epiphany to first show?
Well, my first trip to Eastern Kentucky, to Cordia, was in 1952. And the seed of an epiphany, if you will, was sitting there more like an egg trying to hatch. And then in 58, I really got serious about it and started to propagandize and started to travel around the state, try to talk to governors, that sort of thing. So it was 10 years from the time what you call the epiphany happened until the time that we were on the air.
Well, when you were running KET, what was the biggest challenge you had in operations?
What was the biggest challenge?
Mm-hmm. You got programming challenges against commercial television.
We weren't. No. Wait, Nick. We were never against commercial television. We were never. We were never another television station or network in the area. We were an educational establishment which used television to reach our clientele. Very different thing.
But did you broadcast to the public?
We did, but we weren't shooting for numbers. We weren't trying to. We were giving them something then, where they were giving something they couldn't get anywhere else, and commercial station had no interest in it because the audiences were too small for them. Drama and concerts and symphony and the kind of thing I learned in educational radio. It was something a lot of the audience wanted, and a lot of the audience came to love, though they didn't know they wanted it. You know, they had never had exposure to live at the Lincoln Center. They didn't know what that was, but they came to learn and love it. And so we were providing a total service that wasn't related at all to commercial broadcasters. And incidentally, we had a wonderful relationship with the commercial broadcasters in Kentucky. And one of them sat on our board, two of them actually, and it was always a mutually helpful thing. We did occasionally, when we did candidate forums, they wanted them too, but station in Paducah wasn't going to send a crew up to Lexington for a forum. And so we fed it to them.
So the forum then was seen all over the state.
Well, it was on KET, but it was also on the commercial station. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of partnership projects that we undertook with the commercial station. So it was never us versus them. We were different until we could do things together, and then we did them.
Back to the toughest part of your tenure.
The toughest part?
Yeah.
Toughest part was probably in 1980 when we had the same kind of a budget cutback that we're seeing today. And fortunately, I wasn't required to lay off people. I think they are now. I was just told I would lose 20% of my budget. And the tough thing was trying to do that without losing anybody.
Austerity begins at home, right?
When people retired, we were too young for retirements then.
Yeah.
We started with a lot of young people, and they learned on the job. There weren't any professionals around that you could cop from someplace else. Besides, commercial stations were paying more than we were. So if somebody resigned to go to work for a commercial station for more money, we didn't fill the position. But we just cut. And instead of getting contracts for things, we just learned to do it ourselves.
Facilities, when you started, where did you start?
We started in, and my memory is not certain on this point, I think we started in 11 places at one time, or 12. We didn't have all 16 transmitters to begin with. But we got two within a year or two, I guess it was, one in Paducah and one in Owensboro, because they said, Owensboro started it, they said, hey, you have the string of transmitters across it, and you don't have one here? We're an important city. And they are. And so we said, but we put one in Madisonville, because that way we could reach both the Ohio River and the Tennessee border. And they said, you mean you expect us to rely, I'm speaking for them now, you expect us to rely on a transmitter in Madisonville? I said, well, we guess not. So just about the same time, there was agitation by one of our board members from Paducah, Allie Morgan, for a transmitter in Paducah, too. We didn't have one there. And at the time, Junion Carroll was governor. And you know where he was from. He was
from out west.
Anyway, we were able to convince the administration to fund two more transmitters, one in Owensboro and one in Paducah. So we... Those, but basically, we started with total state coverage at the beginning. And as far as the rural schools are concerned, they got it from the very first day. They got it. And if they didn't, Paul Smith, who was in charge of our technical department for field services, he went out there by golly, and he put up a garbage can cover, a metal garbage can cover, and turned it just so, and they got it.
A satellite dish.
No, it wasn't a satellite dish. It was a transmitter, receiving dish for UHF.
You may want to ask him about the book cover. It's a very, very sophisticated-looking television set.
Oh, yeah. Did you show him the picture?
Yeah,
it's very sophisticated-looking. Do you want to explain, it? Well, first of all, your picture is right in the center, which is just beautiful. Just beautiful. The KET story, a personal account. This is O. Leonard Press. And I don't know who chose the photograph or the cover.
Sid Webb did the whole book, laid it out. But he's an artist and a photographer, and he was my deputy, and he's a production specialist, and he's an artist. Did I say photographer? And he's an all around. But he did the design of the cover and the inside. And the cover is of the camera that preceded the one you said you had. Here,
the Vidicon.
Vidicon, you said. Before the Vidicon, we had the beer case camera.
Sterling beer case.
Well,
I forgot.
You know,
Sterling.
Austere budgeting being what it is and all that, Lynn. This is a cardboard box on a pedestal with a Campbell's soup can in the position of lens, and it is being operated through a cardboard viewfinder. And the brand name of the camera is Sterling Pilsner Beer.
And if you'll notice, the tennis ball cans that form the lens, one is all the way in, one of them is pulled out, the other one is in between. That's what we call a long lens, a short lens, and a middle lens.
Yeah, 35, 70, and...
Whatever, 105 or something.
105, something like that, yeah.
We were able
But the kids were fine with it. You know, they were. Yeah. It was like we trained in the Army before the war. You know,
mark time march and all that sort of.
Well, no, I mean you had broomsticks for guns.
Yeah. Well, so you use that on the floor, probably right in the studio where we are right now.
Yes, sir.
And you could set up shots. You could truck and pan and do all the good.
Yeah, you could stand
moves.
It on its end if you wanted to.
And then after the show, you could open the top.
And have one, right?
Yeah, have one or two. Yeah. O. Leonard Press goes back to the days of WBKY, which I think stood for Beattyville, Kentucky. That's
it
where
did.
The
it
license
did.
Was held originally.
That's right. That's right.
We have in the studio, back to your right, the piano that I've named the Grand Old Lady, Bromo Seltzer from the music school, purloined this piano and another one similar to it and brought them over from the music department, which was not in the fine arts building then.
No fine arts building.
Right. I think this was one of the Splinter Hall.
Yeah. But you know, Nick, come to think of it, I have a picture of the studio with that piano in it.
I'd
and
love,
it may be in the book.
I love
It may be
Florence.
Well, we were able to infuse a great number of photographs, and the one thing that you can say about Lynn is extremely organized, and he has newspaper articles, and he actually went back to KET to do a lot of his research. How long, Lynn? Tell us again how long you worked on the book before you actually even I think gave voice to.
Put a pen to paper. About 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just really, and that's partly why the book is like it is. It was an attempt to document what happened. Mm-hmm. To me, the process was the fascinating part of it, the political process.
I agree completely.
And as a matter of fact, one of the working titles I used early on was a case study of a public sector startup. Which is a description. It's a whole book.
The GED story also, you know, there's so little time to discuss the wealth of information that Lynn has put in his book, the KET Fund for Excellence, but the Martha's GED Army and
Martha Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And, you know, we've covered a lot of the educational part and just scurried over the arts and the cultural, but the GED part of the KET story and its contribution to the people of our Commonwealth is really worth a little more mention if you would, Lynn.
When we started, the first thing, of course, was the school programs, and then the second thing was, what is going to be the second thing? And we sat around a long time thinking about that and started with there are a lot of people who are actually illiterate in Kentucky, and that's the base. And there was a program on trying to teach people how to read and write, but it didn't work. At that level, you need personal instruction. So we went to the next level, which was GED, and we produced what turned out to be the definitive GED television product for the whole country. And it has been now for 34 years, I guess.
Is there some official recognition of that?
Mm-hmm. It's a market recognition, okay? There were two others on the market when we started. They disappeared, and no others have ever appeared. So
it's acclaimed. Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much mm-hmm. the definitive one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very exciting thing. And if I may, Nick, may I have the privilege of the platform?
Sure, sir.
I want to pay tribute to two men who really, without whom I could not have made this possible. And that was Dean M.M. White, for whom I worked as department head of radio.
I knew Dean White very well. In fact,
did you?
He was my advisor.
Really?
He put together this cockamamie plan card of mine and finally found a way to let me graduate. He's quite a little guy. I really loved him.
He scared the...
Oh, he was a little gruff, a little barking.
He scared me. You talk about authority figures, of mm-hmm. whom I'm all in awe of all of them. But he was wonderful. And he gave me the license to spend a little time on this. He also suggested that I ought to talk with the president before I go any further. And so I did. And I cannot tell you how supportive Frank Dickey was. Utterly supportive. I asked him, for example, if he would be willing and able to consider even helping me with the university or the college at that time, presidents, because I needed support at the top in education. And he says, well, as a matter of fact, I'm chairman of their group, and I'd be glad to.
Really?
And he did. And he did. Years later, as he tells the story now, and he loves to tell it, he says, when Len Press came to me and asked me if I would support him in this thing called educational television. I think I thought I knew what he meant, and I liked it. He said, I really liked it, and I was all for it. But then when he started to talk about satellites and using satellites to get from here to there, he thought, I began to fear that I was into something I shouldn't be involved with. He says, I thought he was probably certifiable. Was the word he used.
Certifiable. Yeah.
And then he laughs because, of course, he did. And what he did for me was he gave me permission and support to go see the governor, Chandler at that time,
mm-hmm.
and to take the time. And for the last 2 years, I worked on the UK payroll. I was really working full time. I wasn't teaching anymore. I was working full time on this project.
Traveling.
I was traveling all over the state, and it wasn't until 1963 when the authority was formed and they had a small budget, and they asked me to take the job. I did not want to at first. I did and I didn't. I was very mixed about it. I was head of the department here, and I didn't know if this thing was really going to happen, even with the governor's support. And they offered me the job, and I did take it, and that's when two things. One, the university put me on leave, and two, they informed me that I had 3 years to make up my mind whether I was coming back or I'd lose my tenure. You know, I didn't know I had tenure. I mean, that was like insurance and retirement. I was young. Who thought about things like that?
You have to look back to see if you have tenure.
These days, you know, you have to go through hell to get tenure.
Right.
At that time, it was almost automatic. I was an assistant professor, and I had tenure.
Professor Press.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's got a nice ring to it.
Yeah.
Nice ring to it. Do you get back up to Massachusetts?
For years, we went there every year to see our parents, and then my parents retired to Florida, and then actually we got too involved, and we'd go back once every 2 or 3 years. Now we don't have much reason.
Any regrets, Lynn?
No. Not a one.
I think that's emphatic. What do you think?
He's a Kentuckian.
I feel so fortunate, Nick, so lucky to have come here, to have had this opportunity, and it was an opportunity. I mean, things just lined up right for me to be able to do this. And if I hadn't, somebody else would have, and I'm just so glad I beat them out.
O. Leonard Press, the author, the KET story, it is his story as much as it is KET's, and it's also Kentucky's story. It's a personal account, but it is one of the major reasons why Kentucky is improving in all aspects. Lynn, it is delightful for me to have you here. Florence.
Thank you.
Also you.
Thank you, Nick.
You're listening to Curtains at 8 on WUKY.
That was Archive Curtains at 8 from October 9, 2008, with Nick interviewing Lynn Press alongside Florence Huffman of Clark Publishing and their discussion of Lynn's book, The KET Story. Thank you for listening to 91.3 WUKY's podcast. I'm Joshua Bear, and take care.